Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be speaking with Dr. Jacqueline Kennelly about her fascinating new book published by the University of Toronto Press titled Burnt by Democracy. Now, if you weren't already taken in by how captivating that title is, let me tell you a teeny bit about the book. It essentially explores what democracy feels like, what citizenship feels like, what it means practically to young people today in a bunch of different places that might seem not that similar to each other. But as the book demonstrates, the situations in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the United States, and the UK are actually maybe more similar than we think. So without giving anything else away, Jackie, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you, Miranda. I am thrilled to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
We are very pleased to have you. Could you start us off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. I am a professor of sociology at Carleton University, which is in Ottawa, Canada, the capital of Canada. And I have been working on the sort of questions that animate this book, I would say, since before my PhD, as a young activist myself, as also a young person who grew up in poverty and could see, as I moved into activism, some of the class dynamics. No, that's wrong. I couldn't see them. I came to study them and then could see them. Through my PhD, my PhD project was on youth activism in Canada and some of the class dynamics and gender and race dynamics. And then I shifted my focus to homelessness, youth homelessness in particular. I've been working in that area now for about 15 years, but have always been interested in the question of youth political participation. And that led to a study where I actually was talking to homeless young people in Ottawa about their engagement with democracy and citizenship in the state. And somewhat to my surprise, they really had no meaningful engagement. I had to kind of work through what that meant. That's where the beginning of the theoretical framing for this book happened, and that was back in like 2015. This book I think of as, I want to say culmination, although it's not like the work is ever done, but somewhat of a culmination of those two particular strands of research interest and preoccupation with what it means to participate democratically and how that gets wound around ideas about the good citizen and young people and neoliberalism and the criminalization of dissent that has been happening increasingly in all of these countries, certainly in Canada, the criminalization of homelessness, the growth of inequality. And so, that's where the ideas for the book came from.
There's so many things in what you've just said that, having read the book, I'm like, yep, I see where that came from. Yep, okay, there we go. So lots of threads for us to pull on as we go. But I think, especially because I found it so captivating, the kind of obvious next question for me is, talk us through the title. What does it mean to be burnt by democracy?
Yes, thank you. As you know, Miranda, having read the book, I begin the book with an excerpt from one of the participants, and her pseudonym is Stephanie. And she narrates this really heartbreaking story of the series of state failures that ultimately led to her homelessness, as well as being kind of embroiled in sex trafficking, not being protected from that, and then, you know, ultimately going to university, but having to fund herself through sex work. She's in the US. And as she moved into activism, recognizing herself that the people who were advocating for sex workers, for sex trafficked victims like herself, were not themselves the victims, generally. She herself recognized how much privilege was involved in becoming an activist and being able to advocate for those issues. And she was one of the few of the participants I interviewed who straddled both of those worlds, having experienced homelessness as well as having engaged in activism. And she was very clear that it was her post-secondary education and then the network she developed there that allowed her to do that. And so her reflections really capture the tension that I am trying to gesture at with the title Burnt by Democracy, because all of these countries where I did the study, the five you named, are liberal democracies. They have reputations for being, free, having freedom of the press and freedom of expression and all the things that are supposed to go with liberal democracy. They all have citizenship training, citizenship education within their public education systems. And yet the opportunity to participate in democracy is very much delimited by a person's social class. And it shouldn't be. And I don't think we as a society in any of these countries have really grappled with the fact that being born in a state that claims that everyone is equal is not the same as actually providing the opportunities, the skills, the education, the knowledge that's required to meaningfully participate in those states. And so the burnt by democracy phrase is a kind of young people are raised to believe that we live in a democracy and yet are not able to really engage with that democracy unless they have access to higher education or some other sorts of socialization that are really limited by social class because of the ways in which our societies have evolved largely over the last 40 years, the devolution of the state, the erosion of welfare systems, including state benefits, post-secondary education, affordable housing, and that all of that has created these conditions of ever-growing inequality that make it harder and harder for people who are being most failed by the state to actually engage with the state in a way that allows them to advocate for their own needs, which means we aren't actually living in a democracy, is ultimately one of the conclusions that I come to, that a place is not, I think anyone would agree, a place is not democratic if everyone is not actually able to engage, and especially if that engagement is divided by social class, largely, as well as other categories of social status.
I'd like to pick up on this idea of engagement, both because kind of the big picture points you're already making speak to how central that is to concepts of democracy, for one. But I think there's also kind of a question here around research. So often when we conduct research, especially if it's with like actual people, doing things like interviews, we need some amount of engagement for that piece of it as well. And yet for the reasons you've just spoken about, engagement from people experiencing these things, especially from young people, is not necessarily something we can just kind of take for granted and be like, oh, you must use kind of standard qualitative research methods and there's nothing to see here. I think there's actually kind of a lot to see here. So can you tell us a bit about your methods and data for the book and how you went about sort of making these decisions and talking to some of these people?
Yeah. So the book, the research for the book began in March 2020. Everyone will recognize that timeline as not a great time to embark on a qualitative research project. And of course, the pandemic shut down everybody. I had been intending to go and physically do interviews in the different countries. And it was my sabbatical year. But of course, that changed. And I had to shift to online interviews, which I'd never done before. I'd never done online interviews before. And I think like lots of qualitative researchers who had to make this shift have reflected and will continue to reflect on the sort of surprising opportunities that that opened up, as well as the limitations. I think those of us who do human engaged research appreciate and have theorized the degree to which there is a relationship that exists between the researcher and the participant, and that relationship can shape the level of trust and the access to information. And building a relationship over a screen is different than building a relationship in person. And so there definitely were effects on, for instance, sampling, which I can talk more about. But the positive side effect was being able to access young people from across different regions in each country that probably would have been impossible to do in the kind of limited amount of time that travel permits. So they were interviews. The original design imagined focus groups and perhaps hanging out with young people in their spaces, whether it was homeless drop-ins or activist meetings, but none of that could happen. So it ended up just being the virtual interviews. And I was seeking out young activists in Canada, the US, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand, the kind of group of countries that are called in other resources and other research have been called the Anglo-American liberal democracies, although Ireland should be in there, and I didn't do Ireland. And so activists from those five countries who were pretty easy to recruit, not surprisingly, they're quite present online. And I had a research assistant working with me, and he reached out through different activist networks on Twitter and websites, etc. And it wasn't too hard to recruit young activists. But then trying to find homeless young people from a distance, I knew would be harder. And it was. So in Ottawa, I have longstanding relationships with the homeless serving agencies here. I've worked in this field for a long time. And I was able to attend a drop-in at one of the local centers. Even though it was the pandemic, they set me up in an office with a big plastic thing between myself at the desk and the person who'd come in. And, is where they were still functioning, which was good because it was hard on homeless folks, of course, during the pandemic. And so I was able to interview a number of young people who had experienced homelessness in Ottawa that way. But the young people who had experienced homelessness in the other countries, I needed to be a bit more creative. And I ended up hiring research assistants in each of the other four countries. And I had to find them through academic networks and, colleagues who'd recommend somebody, and then ask them to do the recruiting. And so it differed in each country. But, for instance, my Australian RA, she herself is a PhD student who had been working in youth homelessness. So she also had connections to agencies in Melbourne, but Melbourne was in complete lockdown. Like she was only allowed out a certain amount of time each day to walk around the block. She couldn't actually physically go to these centers herself, but she knew them. And so she was able to contact the workers, and then they would talk to their clients. And if the clients were interested, then they would make the connection back. And so that's how that worked. And the interview questions were very much shaped by the previous research that I already mentioned. Some of the questions very specifically came out of the the more recent research that I mentioned, where I worked with homeless youth in Ottawa to ask them about their engagement with civic life and democracy. For instance, one of the questions I asked everybody, and I asked both groups the same questions, it is also relevant. And one of the questions I asked that came specifically from that research project in 2015 was, do you think of yourself as political? And what does it mean to be political in your view? And that came from the focus groups and interviews and that previous research involved like arts-based and walking interviews. It was much more ethnographic more time to relationship build and recognizing through that research how the idea of politics meant something very different to homeless young people than it did to young activists. And that did prove to be the same across all five of these countries and became, in fact, a really important analytic point that I write about in the book about the very different views of what it means to be political and what that tells us about how exposure to certain types of education and knowledge are necessary for young people to be able to move into a more active engagement with democracy and public life.
Hmm. Clearly, from that discussion of methods, and as you said, it built on kind of your previous work and connections, there was a lot of thinking that went into this, even with, you know, not just because of the disruption of the pandemic. What were your goals kind of coming into the project, into the research, and did they change at all over the course of the process?
It's a little hard to answer in retrospect, you know, because now that it's what it is, it feels like it was always going to be that. But the obvious change was the shift from in-person to virtual and what that meant for the methods as well as the sampling. The piece about sampling that was relevant that I didn't get back to in the last question was the homeless young people in Canada who are in Ottawa, who I could access in person, were much more vulnerable, were in a much more precarious state of life and poverty and desperation than most of the youth I connected with overseas. And I think that's one of the sampling differences, because I couldn't go to a drop-in and just interview anyone who's there. And therefore, it would be a kind of much more random sample in the sense of it's who happens to be using the service that day, and they're using the service because they need it. Whereas the youth I connected with virtually in the other countries, they had to go through this process of being contacted or responding to a poster, agreeing to interview, coordinating with my local RA. Like there are many more steps involved, which almost required them to be in a more stable place in their lives. And you can see the difference. I think you can see the difference in the data, and I comment on that. Back to your question about how did it evolve from start to finish? As I said, I went into the project already with some pretty clear analytical lines that I had already developed in previous projects and questions about whether these things would hold in other places. So both of those projects focused on Canadian young people. But I knew I'd already done work in the UK with homeless young people there on a different project. And so I had a sense of the fact that there would be similarities. And so expanding it, I was unclear in the beginning which countries I would include, because I knew I had a sabbatical coming up, and it was also about where would I be able to travel to. And that kind of evolved, I think, as I applied for a few grants, which I didn't get. This was actually a really low-cost project in the end, because
it was online
and it was all virtual. So all I had to fund was my RA, really. But it, in applying for grants, that shaped it also. Mm-hmm. So, but I do feel as if it ended up pretty close to where it began, because I had already thought, done this sort of research and analytical work. And so it mm-hmm. was a kind of coalescing and confirming of things I suspected, as well as a deepening of the understanding and ability mm-hmm. to kind of make sense of it from a broader perspective.
So it's one of those points, the kind of, to what extent does this hold piece that I'd like to ask about next? Mm-hmm. Because obviously the connection with Canada is very clear. Mm-hmm. Having done work in the UK, that obviously would help going, yeah, I think this might work here. Yep. But any sort of like expanding of places always sort of has that like, ooh, is this going to be similar enough to be mm-hmm. able to make sense of it at all? Yeah. And you actually show in the book that these five countries really are quite similar from this particular lens. Yeah. You spoke a little bit earlier about this being very much about sort of neoliberalism and the types of policies that it does and does not encourage, leading to circumstances around socioeconomic stratification. Could you maybe tell us a little bit more about kind of just how similar you think these things have ended up across the countries, and maybe why we see such striking similarities?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had a educated suspicion that all of these countries would have similarities, which was based on previous work and talking to colleagues. I have, I have other projects ongoing, for instance, on affordable housing in Canada, and I'd connected with Australian colleagues. I have lots of actually Australian youth studies colleagues. And so, you know, I had a same with New Zealand youth studies colleagues. And the US, of course. So, you know, I knew that from what I'd read of other people's work and in conversations and some research I'd done for my other projects, that there were an awful lot of similarities between our five countries in terms of the directions of policy. When I started doing the actual research to find out to what extent that was true, it was actually quite shocking even to me how very, very similar all five of these countries were, because we also, you know, I live in Canada and we pride ourselves on being more progressive than the US. And I know New Zealand, I was so surprised at actually how far into neoliberalism New Zealand had ventured. Because I think of New Zealand as a more progressive place, and it I think it positions itself in the same way in relation to Australia. So when I chose those five with a suspicion that there would be similarities, and then as I started to do the research, it became really clear. And because I do housing research, I had a sense already of some of the housing history, particularly in the UK, in Australia, and in the US. The New Zealand work was completely new to me. But that trajectory from a post-war welfare state, the Keynesian economics that returning veterans demanded and expected, and the institution of the building of public housing that happened in all of these countries to varying degrees, the provision of post-secondary education, the massive expansion of the university sector, the provision of state benefits, welfare and disability benefits and different kinds of social assistance, old age pensions, etc. All of that was post-war and had its heyday in the kind of 60s and 70s. And then there were these kind of global economic panics, I want to say. And you guys got to lead the way with Ms. Thatcher and her her particular approach to, responding to the fears around the economy. And we had Reagan, not we, Canada, the US had Reagan, and we had Brian Mulroney, who actually just passed away the other day. And similar trends in Australia and New Zealand, you know, all of the countries, like all of these countries' economies are linked also, and they're all, their policy folks are talking to one another, they're watching each other, you know, there's research documenting how in Canada, and I think I mentioned this in the book, our CMHC, which is Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, they were keeping a close eye on Thatcher, and as she sold off the public housing, and there was a real sense of, okay, well, we're gonna, that seems to be working over there. We didn't have much to sell off, mind you, but, you know, stopped building any new public housing and withdrawing funding. So, yeah, so I would say I already had a suspicion, and it was confirmed and even, I don't know, beyond confirmed as I began to do the research. And it felt important because, I mean, it's important perhaps for obvious reasons, but also in my own trajectory, you know, I have lived through this, parts of this era, and I kind of narrate that in the book. And I've also been swimming in the sea of kind of economic rationalizations for why governments should cut services and why austerity is necessary and why we need to cut taxes in order to promote, you know, bringing corporations. And that's very much the common sense narrative, that the doxa, to use Pierre Bourdieu's term, the common sense of, you know, my childhood to adulthood has been this neoliberal line. And even though I've known both at the level of experience as well as I began to study it, that just didn't make sense. It was also validating, I want to say, to really dig into it and be like, right, no, none of this is true. It just is ideology. And in fact, when we look at it, what's happened has been a mass transfer of wealth from the poor and middle classes to the rich. And that has been the case in all five of these countries. So, and that it doesn't have to be that way. I think this was another important piece, as myself as a former young activist and certainly still interested in justice and change, to feel like this isn't inevitable. This was the result of a series of policy decisions that could be changed, could be undone and redone better.
Thank you for taking us through that. Now that we have that understanding, not just of kind of what the impacts are, but as you said, just how strikingly similar they are, despite what we might, you know, what the reputations of some countries might be compared to others, let's talk about the effects on young people. Can you walk us through what you mean by the term democratic disposition? Mm-hmm. And the ways in which young people might be kind of more or less able in acquiring it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I mentioned Bourdieu in my last answer. So Pierre Bourdieu is a social theorist whose work has been hugely influential on my own. And he is woven throughout the book, his concepts, as well as Hannah Arendt. And Bourdieu, for, I know this is an academic audience listening, but not everybody knows his work, that he really developed a very complex and comprehensive theoretical framework that helps us understand the ways in which individuals embody the social, that none of us are free from the effects of the social worlds into which we are born, from the level of family to community to education to wider politics and media, etc. We're all shaped by those things. And he conceptualizes that innate experience as, not innate is wrong, feelingly, it feels innate, but is actually socially structured. He calls that the habitus, and he talks about it as a set of dispositions, that we all develop this set of dispositions that we feel as if belong to us, are sort of uniquely personal, but in fact are inevitably shaped by the family, community, world in which we live. in ways we often can't see, or actually we typically can't see unless we have the chance to do this kind of analysis. And so that idea of disposition, the democratic disposition, is very much grounded in that framing of the self in relation to the social world. And the democratic piece of it is recognizing that, as Hannah Arendt says, you know, we're all born with the potential to participate in the public sphere. That's what it means. That's part of what it means to be human, according to Hannah Arendt. But Bourdieu helps us understand that we may all be born with that potential, but there are some who are able to develop it and some who are not. And that's the social and political and economic piece. And so those who have been able to develop a democratic disposition are, and it doesn't have to be this way, but because of inequality, because of histories of neoliberalism, because of the ways in which that has shaped who has access to what kinds of education, the way in which young people develop a democratic disposition has a lot to do with either the families they're born into. Do they have a family who engages democratically in various ways, perhaps in activist ways, perhaps in more kind of conventional formal politics, but, you know, is that something they're exposed to? Those families tend to be, if they are kind of activist or politically engaged, they tend to be middle class or upper middle class, which, you know, speaks to also the history and the reproduction of poverty and access to education, etc. If they don't come from a political family, then they might be pulled in via a type of informal political education that might happen through their peers or through a mentorship or through getting involved in activist organizations that are youth-oriented, like the climate strikes was a huge influence. And or they are exposed in post-secondary, because the post-secondary systems are still places where a kind of activism can happen and might even be encouraged, although that's changing in certain places. And there's the clubs and there's the social justice organizations and there's the classroom where they can learn different things. So I'm not theorizing this. This is what I have observed through the empirical data. And it was what I observed in Canada with young activists back in, it was like 2007 that I did that doctoral work. That work is captured in a different book called Citizen Youth. And it's what I observed this time. Whereas for homeless young people, and I chose homeless young people in part because I've worked with them, but in part in a kind of analytical sense, because they represent sort of the most impoverished, the people who have been most failed by the state. They do not come from political families, or very rarely. They do not have access to post-secondary education. Even if they do have access to post-secondary education, it's often kind of funneled into a sort of you know, very, very pragmatic, like, I need to get a business degree in order to move on. And they don't get the kind of broader political education. So that they ultimately, and one of the kind of markers of a democratic disposition that I observed through the interviews, was this idea of what does it mean to be political? As I mentioned, was a question I asked because of what I'd heard in my previous research project. And the young activists, without exception, described being political as this very broad experience of being in the world and enacting change and collaborating with others and working towards justice. And it expands from, you know, the world in which they live right down to their individual actions and the choices they make. It's a very expansive idea of being political. Whereas most of the homeless young people, unless they'd been exposed to this kind of education, some of them had, But if they had not, which was the majority, they thought of being political as formal politics. If that, sometimes they just had no answer. But if they did have an answer, often they were unsure, or they saw it as the government and like very formal systems focused, who you vote for and who's in power. And that is the form of politics, the idea of being political, that is promoted in citizenship education. Absolutely. I looked at curriculum as well. So very clearly prioritizes formal systems. So the problem with that is especially for these marginalized young people who have been phenomenally failed by the state, is they see absolutely no hope there. There's nothing for them there. They have no access to those people. It doesn't matter who they vote for. They don't even necessarily know how to vote because they haven't received that level of education. But even if they are going to vote, they're not sure who's in power. They're not sure what difference is going to make. All they see is corruption and greed and none of their interests being represented. And so, of course, they don't think that they are political. So those are the differences, some of the differences in the democratic disposition and the way in which young people, I observed young people being able to develop it or not. And of course, if you have this, as the young activists did, this kind of expansive concept of what it means to be political and to engage with others and to have power to make changes at the individual level, at the collective level, it feels much more possible, much more feasible.
Hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that also helps explain kind of how people become activists or who's able to become activists. But is there anything further you'd like to tell us about that piece of it and maybe what it sort of tells us about the pathways neoliberalism has created or hasn't gotten rid of?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as I mentioned, the pathways to activism, and I do have a chapter that kind of breaks it down by sort of broad categories of biography. And the main pathways into activism were, and again, this was consistent with the research with Canadian activists from over a decade ago, coming from an activist family, that was a big one, being politicized through a mentor or other activist organization, or being politicized through post-secondary or other kinds of post-secondary based organizations. Mm-hmm. And so those don't have to be class delimited, but they are. And I think we can see this in the effects of neoliberalism most clearly in the erosion of funding to post-secondary education, which has become less and less and less affordable. And so the sort of stratification between who can access it and who cannot has become more and more marked. But we also can appreciate how other types of neoliberal policies that have led to cuts to the social safety net have deepened those divisions. So lack of access to affordable housing. You know, the knock-on effect of lack of access to affordable housing is instability. You know, what it means for young people who are in a family who can't pay their rent is that they get bounced around and they lose contact with the schools they were at, or they lose motivation, or they don't have access to internet anymore, so they can't complete their courses. You know, there's this really heartbreaking story from one of the young people in England where she was top of her class, was doing really well, and then her family, her mother left the family and her father wasn't able to afford their rent. And so they had to move to a family shelter. And she didn't even have a blanket. She was sleeping on the floor. She didn't have regular internet access. Her grades dropped. And then her school, which was one of these academies, which I had to do research into, and was like, oh my God, what's happening in England to your public education system? Sort of publicly funded and yet privately run school kicked her out because they don't want the drop in grade point average to reflect on their scores. And then she was able to get into a, you know, like a still sort of traditional public publicly funded and publicly oriented school and was able to kind of scrape by and get her A levels but her grades were much lower and that meant, you know, it limited her her options for going to post-secondary. So, you know, the, like, lack of affordable housing and the lack of decent social welfare systems, like, you know, like basic welfare payments. So when a family falls on hard times, they don't completely disintegrate, have all of these kinds of knock-on effects that then create less stability, less access to opportunities that are really tightly associated with post-secondary education or with volunteer time. And that's how these divisions get perpetuated.
Yeah, no, I think that is obviously a very sad example, but a very evocative one to help understand kind of how these big picture things, like what does that actually mean, right? What are the knock-on effects of those things? Mm-hmm. I want to sort of stay in that realm, I suppose, of the book and ask kind of, it sounds like such an obvious question, but I think it's worth raising because some of the answers are perhaps obvious, but some of them aren't less so. What is lost? What do we, kind of the big collective we, lose when these sorts of people, you know, that story or stories like it, unfortunately there's more than one, are disenfranchised, are considered democracy to have burnt them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. It's a wonderful question. I think we lose a lot. And the... besides just the ideal of living in a democratic nation that we like to believe, I think many of us who live in liberal democracies have a sense of pride that this is the kind of system we live in, and then to see that in fact it's not all that democratic is obviously an issue, but it also means that we can't make good decisions. We don't have the input of the people who are being most failed by systems in order to actually improve those systems. And there are all sorts of knock-on effects, all sorts of consequences of people being failed, being burnt by democracy, because when, you know, there have been various, like so many studies that have demonstrated that homelessness costs way more than housing people does, for instance. So if we want to be really crass about the economic effects of failing people. Young people not being educated costs the economy way more than it does to actually fund their higher education because they can't find work and they aren't able to then contribute back to the economy with their wages. You know, we're supposedly moving into or have been for decades now this kind of knowledge economy and yet not providing the building blocks for everybody to have access to that knowledge. And then there is also just about the kind of sense of safety and connection and well-being of the community, you know, the lost opportunities to connect with a wide range of people because we've become so far apart that we don't have those points of contact anymore. And then that also contributes to the reproduction of the system because as there's less and less genuine connection between different groups, then the marginalized groups get demonized and dehumanized and blamed, which is a huge part of the neoliberal logic that emerged in the 80s and 90s in all of these countries is that the poor are to blame for their own poverty. That is the ideology that is at the foundation. I think that's a piece that's so important. And part of what I say in the book is that, you know, we're laboring under this false apprehension of what democracy is. And in some ways, liberalism and liberal democracy has blinded us because it has emphasized the individual to such an extent, and neoliberalism has ridden right in on that and said, yep, it's the individual. The individual has to work hard and pull themselves up by the bootstraps. But that's just not the reality. We don't function as individuals. We function as social, relational beings who, you know, as I was talking about, you know, building on Bourdieu's theories, who are shaped very much by the social world we live in and by the opportunities we have. And until we recognize that, we're not actually going to be able to move towards a genuine democracy that provides space for everyone to express their experiences, not through a vote, because a vote is a very narrow, impoverished idea of democracy. It's almost the epitome of the individualized idea that a person can vote and therefore they've participated in democracy. I mean, voting is one part of it, but is really should be a very small part of how we conceive of democracy, because democracy is about inclusion, it's about community, it's about meeting the needs of everybody and being able to hear from everybody to ensure those needs are met. It's about, you know, it's about equity and justice, and none of that can happen if we are constantly creating and reproducing these extremely uneven playing fields.
There's so many things I could ask you as follow-ups to that, so I will try to restrain myself. But I think taking kind of that last point first, the idea of more than, you know, engagement in democracy is not just voting, though I want to come back to voting in a minute. I was really struck by a section of the book where you were talking, I believe, with Canadian young people about kind of, I'm going to overgeneralize it, but along the lines of kind of, what engagement have you had with public officials at sort of not the national level, but the kind of more direct levels, right? And realizing in your conversation that there were some kind of key practical barriers that young people were facing in engaging with democracy in that sense. And I think we've sort of touched on some of them already in terms of kind of stability of internet connection if you're moving from place to place, and can you even finish an education if you're moving around all the time? You know, there's the practical side. But you also discussed in that section kind of conceptual barriers as well. I'm wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about that to flesh out this idea that engagement with democracy is not just voting.
So I think that piece I mentioned earlier about the idea of what it means to be political is a really great example of this. That if a young person conceives of being political as this pretty narrow concept of voting and of formal systems and you know, the political parties, unless they've had the opportunity to engage with those, which is not typical, then that's just going to seem completely inaccessible. Whereas, you know, the young people who have become activists, and I give examples of this in the book, they have been led kind of step by step through the processes, either by, you know, the post-secondary education or organizations they got involved with, or like their high schools that encouraged them to get involved. You know, there was one young woman in Melbourne who she was attending a private school. And so a very highly resourced private school. And she wasn't super affluent herself, but, you know, comfortable enough that her family could send her to a private school. I think she got some scholarship funds. And, you know, she was the only, maybe one of two people of color in the school. And she was encouraged to become the environment captain. And she really wanted to do a good job at being the environment captain. And so she got involved in the youth climate strikes. And that's where she began to get educated. And then she got connected to this campaign that were working to elect a pro-climate official to their local election. And she campaigned and canvassed and did all this, you know, grassroots organizing, and they succeeded. And it was like this incredible moment for her. And what an education she received. None of that was in school. That was, you know, the school encouraging her and leaving, creating space and her having the kind of headspace and stability in order to take it up. And then she gets connected to this organization that shows her how to engage with the political system as it is. It's not the only way to be political, as the young activists articulate, but if we want to talk about like direct influence on the system as it is. And so she learned that at age 15, 16, grade 10 or 11. And then she's able to take that into the rest of her life. One of the things I theorize using Bourdieu again is this concept of homology, which is, without going sort of too deep down the rabbit hole of Bourdieu's work, is the idea that all of us, we grow up, we absorb ideas about the world, as I mentioned, that are social, it forms our habitus. Our habitus fits within a specific field. It's another concept from Bourdieu. The field is made up of people who are similar to us, with shared interests. We feel at ease there, and it might be a middle-class field or it might be a working-class field, and there's different subfields that shape the social world. And the idea of homology is that some fields are more similar to each other than others. So, for instance, the activist field, with the kinds of knowledge and education that are currently required in order to land there and feel comfortable there, feel like a fish in water rather than a fish out of water, is quite homological, quite similar to the formal political field. And I saw this in the research where young activists could and often did make the shift from the kind of informal activist world into formal political organizing. Some of them ran for office. Others were, really involved in campaigning. Some of them really opposed the formal political system, but they still knew how to work it. Whereas for the young people who've grown up homeless, impoverished, the field that they are inhabiting is so far structurally in terms of attitudes, dispositions, ideas about the world, so far from the formal political world, which is very much a middle-class world, that it's much more difficult for them to step across those fields, for instance, that if they enter into a field of formal politics, they would just feel so uncomfortable. Some of them, many of them, right? Because they would feel like, I don't get what's going on, and I'm not educated enough, I don't know how to speak here, and I don't look right, and whatever. So those again are structural things that are felt as personal, but in fact are not. And if we can recognize them, we can actually set up conditions that allow, for instance, young people who've experienced homelessness to develop the skills and knowledge to be introduced in an appropriate way that recognizes their strengths in the areas that they are less comfortable in and helps them develop those skills if that's what they want, and shift them into engaging in the democratic world, but also opening up our idea of what it means to be political, opening up their conception of what it means to be political. I think the conclusion to the book tries to do this. There are really pragmatic things that can be done, that if we can understand the structural components that shape people's access to engaging democratically in various ways, then we can actually implement different approaches, systems, programs, policies that expand that access.
Given kind of where you ended that very helpful answer, do you want to talk about some of those practical aspects now?
Yeah, certainly. So I think, one of the practical answers is a policy-based one, which is, we need to rebuild the welfare state in all of these countries. It will probably look different. There are lots of critiques of the welfare state as it existed and the ways in which it disempowered people and was humiliating and whatever. That's not the kind of welfare state we want. But to implement policies and practices that allow everybody to have housing, makes housing actually genuinely affordable. Places have done this. Finland has basically eliminated homelessness through housing first and building a whole bunch of public housing. Vienna, it has like the most public housing in the world, and they've weathered this economic collapse and the rise in cost of living, etc., inflation. They've weathered it so much better than other places. So there are examples in the world, and in Canada, I'm part of efforts at the research level as well as at the advocacy level to get our government on board with, moving the housing sector out of the private market, which is where it's been, and much more into the public and nonprofit market, because housing is a right. So, that's like high level policy. Like, let's give everybody housing and create that stability. Let's give everybody access to post-secondary. I mean, we used to have much more widely available post-secondary training. The cost of tuition has doubled, tripled, quadrupled, way faster than the rate of inflation in all of these countries. Student loans have gone up. And that's directly linked to the cuts in government funding to post-secondary. So like, let's fund post-secondary so that everybody can have access. Those are like high level government changes that I would love to see happen. Of course, it depends on who gets voted for, and we're certainly all seeing these terrifying swings to the right. But I think at the more pragmatic level, the sort of like level of organizations or classrooms, I talk a little bit about the kinds of civics education that we could be offering. So the one of the public systems that has remained intact throughout neoliberalism, although it's been shaped in unfortunate ways, but it still exists, is public education. The what we would call K-12, ages 4 or 5 to 16, 17, and all five of these countries include civics education, sometimes a specific course or series of courses, sometimes kind of woven through the curriculum. And as I mentioned earlier, these focus on formal systems of government. And I think that should be included. People need that knowledge. But also, it could be expanded to incorporate these more informal ways of connecting, connecting to community organizations, not in a, like a charitable model, but in a way that is responding to injustice. It could begin from the interests of the students and the kind of issues that they think are most important, and encourage them to do that. And this is happening in certain schools, but it tends to happen in the more elite, either private or kind of higher SES neighborhood public schools. Like, it needs to be a wider practice. And organizations also, like, I think activist groups can learn from this work about how to create more democratic spaces within their activism that take care to be transparent about their processes and allow people who don't come from middle-class activist families to engage, because the rules of engagement are clear and anybody can actually get involved and feel valued. And, again, there are some organizations that do this, but I think they are in the minority. So those are a few and concrete examples of ways that we could be collectively shifting this dynamic.
Mm-hmm. No, and thank you for taking us through them and having the different levels, the kind of big picture policy ones and what organizations can do. nothing's ever going to change if we there's just one kind of way forward. So thank you for taking us through the various options there. And it is, of course, worth highlighting to listeners that the book has loads more detail, though I promise it's not 700 pages. It's actually quite readable. So for anyone looking to get more involved in those details, please do check out the book kind of in full rather than just this version of it. But I do have one final question, Jackie, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. This project has obviously been something you've worked on for quite a long time, has built off your previous research. Is your next project related to this as well? Is there anything you're working on now that this is done that you'd like to preview or highlight?
So I, throughout the writing of this book, I have been involved in other projects that are ongoing. And they are focused more on those kind of pragmatics, those systems changes. So I mentioned that the housing project, I'm leading quite a large housing project here in Canada, where we are assessing the outcomes of our national housing strategy, which was just implemented in 2017, is meant to be addressing the housing crisis in Canada, is doing a not a great job so far. And so that research is looking at the social, economic, health, and climate outcomes of national housing strategy investments and talking to tenants. And my particular focus is young people who have left homelessness and are now living in different types of affordable housing to better understand their experiences in public housing versus in the market on rent supplements versus in nonprofit housing, etc. So that project is ongoing. We've got 5 years of funding. That's going to be one of my main focuses. And then the other big project I've been working on is on school-based prevention of youth homelessness. So Australia has been slowly implementing some really exciting models that we're trying to build here in Canada. There's been one pilot in British Columbia. We're trying to build one here in Ottawa, and also doing sort of research around other places that have implemented different types of prevention programs in schools, like trying to bring schools in as a partner in helping prevent young people from falling into homelessness, because, you know, young people do universally have contact with schools, even if they lose it over time. So so those are my research focuses. But this interest in democracy and activism and you know, meaningful engagement flows through all of that. I also run a research center. It's called the Center for Urban Youth Research, and that's actually, I'm working on a handbook with my PhD student. It's called the Handbook of Youth Activism, and that is going to be a resource guide. That it's a collection of short chapters. It's meant to be a kind of introduction to the field of youth activism, which has been emerging over the last decade or so. And it's distinct from the social movements field. My fingers are in all of these pies, and they're all kind of related, but different emphases.
Well, thank you for taking us through them just even a little bit. They do very much link up with each other. So great to kind of know that that's all going on. And of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, again, titled Burnt by Democracy, Youth Inequality and the Erosion of Civic Life, published by the University of Toronto Press. Jackie, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you, Miranda. This was a wonderful, wide-reaching conversation. I really appreciate it.